I'm Shelley Schlender. This is How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. Today is Tuesday, November 25th, 2025. Coming up, we hear about a game-changing way to make steam from Colorado State's Todd Bandar.
What's interesting about steam is it's the main ingredient in industry.
And then, while the U.S. government did not send a delegation to the World Climate Conference, CU Boulder's Max Boykoff was there. He'll share a report.
There's over 1,000 documented oil and gas lobbyists there, too. It is a lot of negotiation about the future of the planet basically happening before our eyes.
We begin with some kitchen science about how to make steam. First, you get water from the kitchen sink. You put water in a kettle or a pan. Now we'll heat up the water, either with gas on the stove or with an electric kettle. When it's hot enough for tea, the water will also be making steam. Steam is an essential product for many industries, for turning turbines, for making cement. Over one-third of the fossil fuel burned in U.S. industry is used for heating up water to make steam. In theory, a heat pump would be more efficient. A heat pump siphons heat energy out of the environment and concentrates the heat. This is less expensive than gas or electric heating. The Department of Energy reports that heating your home with a heat pump can reduce your electricity use for heating by up to 75%. But heat pumps warm a home rather slowly, and most can increase heat by only 40 or so degrees Fahrenheit. That's enough to stay warm at home, but not enough to boil water. That may change thanks to a heat pump created by Colorado State University professor Todd Bandar. It's such a game-changing invention, Time magazine recently named Bandar one of their climate innovators of the year. You can see an early version of the heat pump in action at New Belgium Brewery in Fort Collins. From Rocky Mountain Community Radio, Aspen Public Radio's Michael Finelli speaks with Bandar about his new heat pump.
There's one main product that you develop, right? This industrial heat pump?
Yeah, it's a steam-generating heat pump, and it's a super powerful heat pump. Basically going from really, really cold, you know, below 0 degrees F, all the way up to 400 degrees F steam that we're delivering. So it's a huge temperature lift. A lot different than what you would see, for example, at your home. So it's different technology and requires very, very, very efficient core, you know, compressors, basically, and lots of heat integration. And this is basically my area of expertise that, you know, I've been developing for the last couple decades. What's interesting about steam is it's the main ingredient in industry. Steam is used to make beer, but it's used for all sorts of products, even sunscreen, milk, paper products, you name it. And by electrifying it, we can have a huge impact. So just to give you a sense of like the impact, about 8% of all energy consumed in the world is used to make steam for industry.
Wow, that's fascinating. Yeah. I did not realize that.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking, you know, how much steam is used. I mean, steam is literally the ingredient that drove the Industrial Revolution. And it really has not been, the steam boiler has not been reinvented in 160 years. And so that is basically what we are doing, is we're taking, you know, homegrown innovation in the U.S. and using it to reimagine the boiler room and electrify it.
It sounds like the main difference between like the electric heat pumps we might have in a home or building and this is that these require a bigger heat transfer because you're creating steam out of it.
Yeah, exactly. You're making steam, you're not making warm air. So it has a huge temperature rise. Here's another really key innovation, though. We are making a product, not a project. Industry wants our product because we can literally land it, connect electricity, connect feed water, and connect steam, turn it on, and don't even interrupt their process at all.
What makes it so efficient?
The compressors are the engine of the heat pump. If you want a very efficient car, you have to have an efficient engine. We essentially have the most efficient compressor technologies incorporated inside of our heat pump. The other thing that we do is we take great care in capturing all the heat within the cycle. So the incumbent option to electrify steam is basically a resistance boiler. So you get one unit of heat out for one unit of electricity in. We, through a heat pumping, cut that in half. And that is really what makes it more efficient.
Why do you think this was recognized to be on that list with all these forward-thinking leaders?
Well, it's kind of like an underappreciated challenge, right? Steam is so ubiquitous, and it's not something we really talk about. We talk about cars, talk about airplanes, don't necessarily talk about steam for industry. And so I think that is one of the things that interested them. The other thing is, I've always wanted to have a real-world measurable impact. Like, this is not some fake solution on a piece of paper. You can go to New Belgium, you can touch it, you can hear it, you can't smell it because zero emissions. And it's literally started in a lab, became a prototype, and is now a pilot in the field, ready to scale, to address this major challenge.
Well, congrats again, and thanks for taking the time to chat today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, see you, Michael.
I'm Shelley Schlender. Time to make some tea. Ooh, nice and hot. Maybe Bandur's style of heat pump will boil water for me someday. And bigger versions might replace industrial boilers that normally make steam from natural gas. This report was shared with us by Rocky Mountain Community Radio. I'm Shelley Schlender. This is How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. We're listening to music from Brazil, where the 30th World Conference on Climate Change has just concluded. The U.S. government did not send a delegation to the World Climate Conference, but some Americans went anyway. They include CU Boulder's Max Boykoff. Boykoff shares this report.
My name is Max Boykoff. I've been a faculty member at the University of Colorado Boulder. This is my 17th year now. I'm a professor in environmental studies. I'm also a fellow in the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences, where we're sitting now. And then I've just taken up a new position on campus as the faculty executive director of the new Buckley Center for Sustainability Education.
Max Boykoff, you've also just come back from a big meeting about climate in Brazil.
Yes.
Can you tell us about the COP30?
It's called Conference of the Parties. This is the 30th. In 1992, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change had put forward plans for there to be this annual meeting that takes place. George H.W. Bush actually signed it, and it was ratified by a functional U.S. Senate at the time. It set forth a set of meetings beginning in 1995 that went every year. It's out of sync by a year because of the COVID-19 pandemic, where they didn't have talks for a year. But now this is the 30th in that line of annual Conference of Parties meetings.
So this is those world climate talks, the idea being that if climate change affects all of us and the air goes everywhere, we need to work together to keep the climate from warming up more.
That's right. The United States did not send a delegation.
The United States did not send any delegation this year officially.
That's right. They were one of only four countries. If you were to try and guess which those were, I'll spare you. It was Afghanistan, it was Myanmar, and it was San Marino, along with the United States. It's the first time the United States hasn't sent a delegation, and the United States has really cast themselves outside of this ongoing work for collective action to combat climate change.
Well, that's right, Max Boykoff. There's a strong feeling of wanting to have climate change research and climate change programs in the United States, but that's not the current political environment. There are people in Boulder and in many states who don't believe that humans are the cause of climate change.
This is an outlier perspective that is being embodied in the Trump administration right now, but the rest of the world is moving on. the place where I just was, over 60,000 people involved. The world is moving forward without the United States' official delegate participation.
The world is moving forward without the United States. But you were there. Were there other people from the United States there at this conference?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the many contradictions that we're working through and navigating together right now, is that the United States has been a leading country with universities and researchers and federal laboratories that are doing a lot of this work. And I was representing the University of Colorado Boulder and doing some of that work and talking about some of that work there as well.
You mean that the United States has led much of the research for how we can predict how the climate might change and what the inputs are that make it more likely that the climate will warm? The United States also has done a lot of the primary research for creating technologies for making solar panels, for making batteries that could go in cars. We haven't always been on the leading edge of producing the products, but we've been primary researchers in the United States for these green technologies.
That's right. And that's one of the sad contradictions that we're facing right now. Being the wealthiest country on the planet, the federal administration that is stepping away from climate policy action is really in contradiction with the way in which we've been conducting a lot of the research here in the United States and moving forward with technologies and ways to alleviate the negative impacts of climate change. I don't think I'm saying anything that's controversial. I'm also just stating the facts, and I'm not evaluating this in left-right politics. I can provide to you many politicians that are self-identifying as Republicans that have been very involved in this. I'm identifying this in climate terms. And when we look at the facts around climate change, this is the situation that we're in. And so it's part of my responsibility to explain this in a way that is accurately representing what's going on.
It's my understanding that there was a push from the Trump administration to cut out climate research funding and climate-based projects. But many of the states, senators and representatives said, we actually want to continue funding this. And they did.
CSIS is one of 16 cooperative institutes in the country, the largest. There's several that are within quote-unquote red states, Oklahoma, Alabama. When these senators, members of Congress, representatives start to see that this negatively impacts their constituents, they start to voice their support for this ongoing work.
So you had funding to go to Brazil for this World Climate Conference that came from where?
It's funding that I have through the university as a researcher and as a professor.
And even though the United States did not send an official delegation, what would you guess about how many people from the United States were there?
Good question. I'm not sure I could answer that. It's such a large conference. I certainly saw a lot of people that I recognized that had badges with United States institutions, but it's hard to probably have a number for that.
Out of the 60,000 people that were there, do you know how many people were there from Boulder or from Colorado?
Yeah, so one of the nice opportunities that we pursued there together is that we're forging a partnership with Colorado State, with Colorado College, and with UCAR to talk about work that is being done here in the state of Colorado on climate change, locally, regionally, nationally, and around the world.
Now, I know what Colorado State means, Colorado State in Fort Collins, and Colorado College in Colorado Springs. How about UCAR? What is that?
So it's attached to the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and it is a place that's conducting a lot of climate science research here in our region and in our state.
Okay, so even though the Trump administration did not send official delegates there, a lot of scientists from Colorado were representing the United States, or at least representing themselves and their institutions.
That's right. And as we came together in collaboration, one of the things that a Colorado State professor pulled together primarily, and then we helped facilitate, was bringing together some of the former negotiators in the Biden administration who are still there in different capacities to talk with students that are at U.S. institutions. So while we were there, we pulled that together, bringing together interested students who can talk through where they see these challenges going with those that used to be on the negotiating team, the delegation.
Okay, so that's the background for you going to this climate conference that the United States did not officially go to, but you were there and many other people from the United States were there. And yet you say that even though folks like you were there, that the climate conference and the world are moving They're moving ahead and leaving the United States behind. What do you mean by that?
There's a lot of movement for decarbonization of our industry and society, and there are a lot of financial incentives to be moving forward with the clean energy economy. And so there are many other folks that are taking advantage of those economic opportunities. And when the United States doesn't send a delegation, they're not part of those discussions.
The United States was not officially part of those discussions on how to reduce the amount of CO2 in the air that is making a rapid warming of the climate in a serious and dangerous way. What countries do you think are leading the way right now, since the United States is not?
I myself observed China stepping forward, Brazil as one of the hosts definitely stepping forward, many of the European nations stepping forward with plans to move forward on decarbonization. Some African countries stepping forward that are representing LDCs, as they're called, lesser developed countries, voicing their positions. Pacific Island nations, Tuvalu, had some outspoken representatives talking about sea level rise and the impacts that they're facing now. And so there are movements to address loss and damage, as well as adaptation that these countries are facing, those that have contributed very little to the challenges that we're facing, but are at the forefront of these climate impacts.
So many nations and many people were saying we're already being affected by higher oceans, by worse storms. How about the countries that you said were strong contenders for leaders now? China is an example. Brazil is an example. What are they doing about this?
They're pressing ahead with negotiations to meet the terms of the Paris Agreement. That is largely a voluntary agreement. There's these nationally determined contributions, though, that each country has had to put forward. And so in these periods of time, there's assessments of how those countries are doing in their meeting their emissions reductions commitments. And then collectively together, there's what's called a global stock take to see what overall how countries have been meeting those demands. And so that's work that's ongoing and work that they're finishing up as we speak today.
Okay, so lots of measurement, lots of gathering data. But also there's countries that are doing more actually to reduce their emissions by making electric cars, by using more energy, by doing the plan that was started at National Center for Atmospheric Research by some researchers there to have power lines that went across a whole country, across thousands of miles, to get power from wind farms and solar fields to places that need the power. China's doing that, is that correct? High voltage power lines crisscrossing the nation, going thousands of miles from a place that has power to a place that needs it.
That's right. And then they're also offering those technologies and possibilities within other countries as well. Adoption of electric vehicles, China is definitely moving forward there too. And so we can see this as we visit other, if we have the privilege to visit some other countries and see this in those places.
Did you see those famously not seen in the United States Chinese cars at the conference that you went to in Brazil?
I don't know if I saw them, but I heard that they were there. Yeah, I hear that they are moving forward. I think it's BYD, Build Your Dreams, these low-cost electric cars that are becoming available in many other countries.
They sound like they're marvelous. It's like taking a cell phone with all that technology and making it big enough to be a car and that comfortable and making it small so that it can go a lot of places, making it have a really good battery. It's a whole different way to build a car, and it's very popular and not expensive.
Yep.
But we can't get it here.
That's right. It's an example of the sorts of technologies, the sorts of opportunities that we have to move forward in exciting ways, in move forward in a clean energy economy in ways that can help contribute to our own happiness and satisfaction of our livelihood needs.
Were people at the conference saying they would buy things like this?
I didn't talk with folks about those sorts of topics there, so I don't really know.
But you saw a lot of the possibilities there. You saw other countries making solar panels, making products that we think about as clean products.
Yeah, so in the Blue Zone, which is a place where you can go with credentials, where you can then observe negotiations. So I went as an observer. This university is an observer organization. So you can go into the negotiating halls for those sessions that are open to the observer organizations. But then outside of that, in this vast expanse, are many pavilions talking about oftentimes these kinds of technological opportunities that are being brought forward by other companies in other countries. And so you're walking through that a lot of the time. There's exhibits and other places where people can learn much more about all of these new opportunities that we have.
Okay, so the people at this conference are talking with each other and making deals and signing contracts to get economic projects started that have to do with the companies there and the places there that are doing green projects.
That's right. And there are still many, there's over 1,000 documented oil and gas lobbyists there too. It's a conversation. It is a lot of negotiation about the future of the planet basically happening before our eyes these past 2 weeks.
Max Boykoff, CU Boulder environmentalist and professor in all of those different ways. Even the New York Times has advertisements right now about how fossil fuels can be clean if only we get rid of regulations. That's a common ad at the New York Times today. Do you think that that's true?
No. Rising is a whole other piece of things. And one of the initiatives that I've been getting involved in through the UN, it brought me to the UN General Assembly in September, and it brought me onto a panel at this meeting in Belém, is looking at information integrity. And what's being done is to combat mis and disinformation through media and also through advertising and public relations. And what I've been researching here and part of what I've been talking about in these circles in the United Nations has been putting forward a compact that's been signed by 13 nations as of this past week to combat mis and disinformation.
Max Boykoff, these ads have been on the New York Times in their audio sections. It makes it sound like the fossil fuel industry is doing wonderful things. If only they had less regulation, they could do a better job of being clean and productive for the United States. You probably heard those ads.
I've heard some of them, yeah.
You don't believe that they're accurate?
I mean, they're making claims that are out of step with the conversion scientific agreement that these oil and gas products are contributing to this the harmful effects through climate change. So making claims about the prosperity that's gained through the use of fossil fuels. And historically speaking, we have gained a lot. But we're now at a point where decarbonization of industry and society is the wise financial and environmental and political set of choices that we must be making collectively.
How are people at the conference responding to having oil and gas lobbyists there?
Some talk about that throughout, about how they're gaining access to these spaces when indigenous communities in Brazil themselves are having trouble getting in to those same spaces.
Meaning that the oil and gas lobbies can get in, but the tribes of the Amazon, as an example, have much more trouble getting into this conference.
And so when I was there last week, there were a few demonstrations. Movements and indigenous voices pushed their way into the blue zone. There was another demonstration blocking the entrance and then raising those objections.
CU Boulder has been part of that in terms of one of the delegates or one of the people who came from CU Boulder is an expert on how much the indigenous communities around the world are being affected disproportionately due to climate change.
Ganlin Lyons is a professor who's in the Institute for Behavioral Science, and she's been working with this group, the Governor's Forest and Climate Task Force. She has been working with subnational actors throughout the Amazon region for many years, and she put together many different events. I participated in one of those as well with governors and elected officials throughout the Amazon region talking about the importance of forest conservation to climate change. And she's been doing a tremendous amount of positive work in those areas.
Carbon offset credits. Are you optimistic about those ideas as a way to balance all of these equations, or are you cynical or skeptical?
I mean, I think you raised several points there. Carbon sequestration, you can think about just even as something as basic as when we plant trees, they can sequester carbon from the atmosphere. But what you're talking about, I think, is some of these larger projects that are being proposed. And there's been, I think, rejuvenated interest from technological optimists who think that perhaps we could just create these large-scale carbon sequestration projects of various sorts and not really have to change our habits. It certainly isn't all that we need to do. We have to be really careful about ethical, moral relations around who's controlling these technologies and what kinds of impacts they have for local communities.
Max Boykoffs, thanks for taking the time to share with us what it was like to be at the Conference on World Climate Change in Brazil when the United States officially wasn't there, but you were.
Thank you very much for this conversation.
I'm Shelley Schlender. CU Boulder's Max Boykoff attended this year's 30th World Conference on Climate Change in Brazil, along with several other Colorado scientists. They're working together to find ways to continue climate research and climate action. We'll link to a recent report about their efforts on our website, howonearthradio.org. That's all for this edition of How on Earth. Our executive producer is Beth Bennett. This week's show was produced and engineered by me, Shelley Schlender. Our theme music was written and produced by Josh Cutler. Additional music from Brazilian artist Yvonne Lins. Visit our website at howonearthradio.org to find past episodes, extended interviews, and you can subscribe to our show through Apple Podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Blue Sky, and X. Questions or comments? Call the KGNU comment line at 303-447-9911. For How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, I'm Shelley Schlender.